This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States,
a podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you,
a podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. This week, we are going to discuss the changes over the last 20 years in the U.S. military and the way the changes in the U.S. military of various kinds affect the position and future of the U.S. military and U.S. foreign policy and the relationship between the United States and other parts of the world. We are very fortunate to be joined by an old friend in many ways, an old student, Nathaniel Lauterbach. Nathaniel is an active duty U.S. Marine Corps officer, and he goes by Nate, so we're going to call him Nate here, though we probably should call him Colonel Lauterbach. He recently commanded a squadron in California. Before that, he was an operational planner and strategist in the 2nd Marine Aircraft Wing, responsible for war plans and long-range planning for all U.S. combat marine aviation on the East Coast. That's a huge job. Nate served as a lead planner for NATO as well, and he's been deeply involved with efforts to integrate military robotics and artificial intelligence into the Marine Corps. In some ways, this all started when Nate grew up in Wisconsin, and I had the great fortune of being his professor in the early 2000s at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And as always, it's a great source of pride to see my students doing such important work, especially through public service, to serve our country and to serve democracy. So, Nate, thank you for your service and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction. And honestly, it's a pleasure to serve and it's a calling. So I take it any time anyone can say thank you for your service. It means a great deal. Thank you so much.
Well, we mean it sincerely.
And I should say, is that all the opinions that I'm going to say today are strictly my own and don't represent those of the Department of Defense, the Marine Corps, or any other organization with which I'm associated. Thank you.
Zachary is with us as well. How are you today, Zachary?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very well. In lieu of Zachary's poem, today we have some words from George Kennan. And those who have worked with me or talked with me about foreign policy know how important George Kennan is to me, and I know he's important to Nate and others who serve today. George Kennan was one of the leading American diplomats of the World War II and post-World War II period, also one of the leading writers and thinkers about American diplomacy, about the use of military force, and the democratic purposes of the United States in the world. And in 1950, George Kennan gave a very important series of lectures that were later published under the title American Diplomacy. It's a little tiny book that I assign year in and year out. It's still in print. It's probably one of the most read little books on American diplomacy. And I just wanted to read a few lines from it, from the end of one of his lectures that I think are relevant for where we want to go in our discussion with Nate today. So I'll read these lines and then we'll go right into our discussion. George Kennan in 1950 said, "There is no more dangerous delusion, none that has done us a greater disservice in the past or that threatens to do us a greater disservice in the future than the concept of total victory. Instead, our own national interest, not total victory, is all that we are capable of knowing and understanding. To many, that might smack of cynicism and reaction, even low expectations. I cannot share these doubts. Our national interest is all that we are really capable of knowing and understanding." Nate, as someone who's been at the center of defending the national interest, does that resonate with you?
It does. It really does. I think the reason why is, I'd even probably take it a step further, that sometimes I think that the most sure among us, we might think that we do actually know what the national interest is, but upon reflection, I think it's actually even more difficult than what he actually, than the way he expresses it. Sometimes the national interest, in the wake of an attack or some sort of tragedy that befalls your nation, it can appear to be very clear. And then with time and reflection, it is less so. So, yeah, it's poignant. I appreciate that.
Well, and just building on your really thoughtful comments, Nate, how have you, over the 22 years that you've been in uniform, how have you seen the role of the military and the way the military defends the U.S. national interests? How have you seen that change?
Sure. I think that the way that has changed a lot is sort of the nature of service. When we began over the 22 years, what had happened is the September 11th attacks and the immediate push into Afghanistan, I was not a part of that. And then the immediate invasion into Iraq, and I was not a part of that either. But the subsequent occupations of both and the counterinsurgency operations that we undertook for decades, really, across both those countries. The way it initially was expressed was sort of it was an all-volunteer force. And it was on the backs of a quite small number of people who would continually deploy. I myself had 5 combat deployments, 1 to Iraq and 4 to Afghanistan myself.
Wow.
And there was, you deploy, you train, you do the thing, and then you come on home. And then there's a very good chance that if you're sticking around, you're going to end up doing it again and again. And over time, I think that has sort of changed a little bit with the withdrawal from those countries and then with the changes of that are going on in war overseas right now, whether it's operations that the Israelis are undertaking in Gaza or in Ukraine, like that all volunteer forces kind of, you probably cannot rely on something like that. It's probably going to take something a little bit bigger for the way that war is changing and the technology is affecting it. And the nature of our adversaries is changing as well. So over time, I'd say that the in terms of continuity is like there's a group of professionals, military professionals who undertake these things. But in terms of the change, like I think the level of commitment and the whatever is coming next in terms of combat, it's probably going to demand a little bit more than those professionals are able to muster, and it's probably going to take something a little bit more from the American people. And that has a lot of ramifications for civil military relations in the country, the relationship between the United States military and the people and the government, and the relationship between our elected leaders and the military itself as well.
Sure. And we have been an all volunteer force since the early 1970s, and most experts would say that's worked pretty well, but you think that's reached the end of its shelf life?
I think it's fraying. Yes, the amount of casualties I think that might be expected in the future battlefields will certainly be affecting that. And advanced technologies, the change in technology. And even just the change in the way countries are mobilized, new information operations and social media, all playing a role in mobilizing our adversaries and also having to potentially play a role in mobilizing ourselves in order to fight. It could be a bit of a different kind of a future in terms of how the military relates to that and with how you mobilize a population to fight and how you encourage that population to fight, and also encourage people to those who do not want to fight. How do we put them to productive use with when your nation is also at war? Yes, I believe that it is the all volunteer forces fraying in places, and there may be a different kind of a future involved with that.
Wow, Zachary,
help us understand, please, how it affects morale and how it affects the way that the military sees itself and the way that members of the military see themselves if we are reliant on an all-volunteer force as opposed to a more conscription-based model.
That's a really interesting question. I think that there's a lot of value that comes with an all-volunteer force. You're able to really professionalize the type of folks who are involved in it, especially those who go back and continually deploy and are involved in operations, and at the same time, you're able to invest in their continuing education. I have a I picked up multiple master's degrees in the course of working with the Marines as one of their officers. And that has been a positive thing, and that's led to a more professionalized force. However, I would also say that the military with an all-volunteer force tends to be a family business. And I think the statistics sort of bear this out. We tend to have our most lucrative recruiting grounds in the southern United States and in the Midwest. And we're able to grab certain types of demographics relatively well. And at the same time, we're also we are less able to recruit folks from other demographics in other parts of the country. So that has effects on the nature of the force that you're recruiting and the way that you fight. And if we're going to go ahead and take advantage of all of the changes in technology and the best and the brightest of all that our nation has to offer in terms of its people, a more broad base of support might be necessary in future wars.
I think, Nathaniel, it'll be super helpful to get from you a sense of what are the skills that you think are most needed now to be an effective soldier or to be an effective Marine, maybe to be more specific. I think people have a sense, a sort of image of a doughboy from World War II, and I think it's very different today, right?
I think it is. Technology changes that. There's a certain amount of, I think, self-sufficiency that is required more nowadays of the individual soldier or Marine or airman because the effects of the munitions that we're having to deal with on the battlefield forces dispersion of people. So it requires different types of leadership, more personal leadership, and tighter groups of people that are fighting. At the same time, services, anyone can serve. Like, there may be issues with the way we recruit and levels of motivation involved in the populations that might serve. However, the way recruiting can happen, for example, in World War II, virtually any kind of human being could go ahead and serve their country, particularly back then if you're a male. But if you're nowadays, like, it's with an all-volunteer force and the combat exclusion lifted for women, like, virtually the entire population could potentially serve. And I think that it may not be a bad idea for the American population to consider what that would look like.
And how has your experience as a soldier changed over your 22 years? How have you seen these differences mean things for your life?
On a personal level, I'll say this, the way adaptation happens, and I'll put it this way, you can strike all this. War and combat requires mutual adaptation by all the combatants. Everything that happens on the battlefield is going to have a counteraction and a counter reaction from all the sides, and everyone's going to try to counter the moves of the adversary, and that's going to have effects on the way you fight and virtually every type of thing that relates to combat itself, whether it's your logistics, whether it's even things like during the Iraq and Afghanistan war, they spoke about the golden hour. The golden hour being the ability to move casualty on the battlefield to a certain level of medical care within that 1 hour, and that allowed for greatly improved chances of survival. And will that continue to persist in the future? Probably not. The nature of the adversaries we're fighting and all the technology we're having to deal with, it's going to be a little, it's likely going to put strains against that. So that requires adaptation of their forces, both at the military unit level and then also at the individual level. You have to come to grips with the nature of the threat. You have to take the training seriously. And you also have to be sort of nimble on your feet that the adversary is going to try everything they possibly can to win. And that's going to, and they're going to attempt to do everything they can to take advantage of any kind of predictability that you have, and take advantage of everything that you know as a combatant. And it's going to, and they're going to exploit virtually every weakness that you have. So that presents lots of psychological forces against the individual, as well as, you know, moral forces at the team, the platoon, the company, and the squadron battalion levels, and all the way on up.
Well, you've given us a very vivid sense of that. Zachary?
How do you think the politics of the military plays into this? I'm thinking you mentioned the changes in technology, and one thing that's been discussed a lot is how, you know, the sort of pork belly nature of a military defense contracting prevents investment in the most critical new technologies as opposed to the older technologies like shipyards, building big ships, et cetera. But also, of course, the politics of conscription or sort of more widespread military service as well. How can we think on the one hand about these serious strategic issues and about the politics of all of it, which obviously complicates the story?
Yep. That's a very interesting question. It's not an easily solved. There's not a simple answer to that. In a democracy in particular, we have to remember that, you know, there's multiple forces at play. You have the government and the government's policy. You have the military itself, and then you got the people. And each one of those agents brings different things to the fight when your country is going to war. And one thing I will say too is that it's the country, it's the nation, it's the state that goes to war. It is not the military. The military conducts combat. And so when the American people are at war, it is quite literally the American people through American government policy that drives that. And that also informs how the military is created. It informs how it fights. So perhaps if, you know, looking back into history, you know, we did not have standing armies, and I don't really think we have a standing army today. We do have a professional army, but it is relatively small, and it doesn't really conduct occupation duties at home. So understanding that. That's essentially the army that you go to war with. Previously, we would raise armies for specific conflicts. So you essentially build a purpose-built army for whatever war you're going into. The Cold War invalidated that assumption because we found that we needed to be able to go to war much quicker. So all those types of political considerations, the nature of technology, the interconnectedness of the world, our relationships with our allies, and even simple things like basic geography, which for the most part doesn't change. All those things have great impacts on how the forces organized, how it fights, and the relationship between the people, the government, and that military that it forms in order to conduct those operations on behalf of the American people.
Just building on Zachary's question, Nate, and your excellent answer, George Marshall, of course, the great general during World War II, and then the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. He famously, when he was in uniform at least, never voted. I'm not advocating that, but he never voted because he said he believed the military should be completely nonpartisan. Do you think the military is nonpartisan? And if so, how would you describe that in a world today where, you know, everything seems to be partisan, unfortunately?
Yes, that's a wonderful question, and it bears discussing. The military is political; it's a political instrument, and just its employment causes political effects. And if the military is blind to those political effects, then quite frankly, it's probably not doing its job very well. It is very much an instrument of politics and an instrument of policy. However, it is also absolutely essential, especially in a democracy like ours, that the military and its officers and its enlisted men and women who make up the force remain nonpartisan. And we have there's laws that relate to that. There's policy. There's orders that all support that ethic of nonpartisanship. Occasionally, it is honored in the breach. Occasionally, you know, mistakes are made. But in general, I think that the ethic holds quite well, that the military is a nonpartisan institution. And people may vote. How would they vote? You know, the military is going to probably, you know, if you were to ask it to vote, it's going to vote in a certain way. I personally, I am a, a strong believer in democracy, but I also hold to the general Marshall ethic of not voting myself, believing that nonpartisanship is very, very important. And that's just my own personal choice. Mm-hmm. I choose to exercise it that way. Sure. Certainly that is not the case across the entire military, but Marines and soldiers and airmen and guardians and sailors are encouraged to vote. We have voting programs for them, but we do strongly limit their political activity. And fundamentally, when I talk to my Marines and sailors about that, I say that when you have the honor and the burden of wearing the nation's cloth, you represent all Americans. And what that means is we have freedom of speech rights. We have similar rights to those of other Americans, but they're a bit attenuated at times. And that is appropriate given our nonpartisan, but still political nature as a sort of a political instrument.
Yeah, it's very well said. And I'm sure I'm sure we're going to agree on this. And the military serves the Constitution, right? Your oath is to the Constitution, not to any particular individual or any particular party, correct?
Absolutely. And yes, the oath is precisely to the Constitution. And loyalty is owed both to the president, up the chain of command to the president, as well as to Congress for various things. So it is very much an actor inside of this democracy. But fundamentally, loyalty is to the Constitution itself.
Right. So you would not, and I'm sure you spend lots of time training on this, there's a long tradition of not following any legal order, which is to say not following an unconstitutional order.
That is correct. Yeah. We will follow orders. Our duty is to follow lawful orders. It is to not follow unlawful ones. It's a very simple thing. Determining what that is complicated, but there are processes and procedures for doing that.
Right. Zachary?
Do you think this sort of constitutional obligation, the sort of central role of the constitutional obligation, is something that sort of young members of the military that you work with understand, embody? Is this something that motivates people to join, or is this something that has to sort of be taught or instilled in them?
I think the answer is yes. we do speak about it, and I keep a constitution with me. Not that I refer to it all the time, but more as a reminder of what I am serving and what my obligations are. And we do emphasize that. And even when political seasons come around for elections and things are becoming more politically charged in the media, we will, unit leaders will emphasize, hey, here's your role. It may be, you may have opinions on this, but you know what? You can talk about that. You can talk about it with your teammates, what have you. But if you're in the workplace, we're not talking about it. That you can keep that to yourself. Our job here is we follow orders and we execute orders and we plan to follow orders and things of that nature. And by orders, I mean lawful ones. So yes, it is something that it should motivate people to serve. I will say that motivations to serve are as wide, as diverse as the entire force. People can join for any number of reasons. I just love serving my country. I love serving something greater than myself, and I love my country and I love serving. It's that simple. So, and it's kept me in for 22 years now at this point. So they're doing something right.
Yes. Well, we're fortunate to have you. Sort of looking forward, because I know you've done so much work in the planning space around technology, but also around force structure and things of that sort. How do you plan for future threats in a world, Nate, where there are so many threats, where there are great power threats, there are counterinsurgency threats, there are terrorist threats? How do you do that? And how do you think about the future of the military in that context?
It's the future is murky. It's always hard, right? It's a very challenging thing to do. There's a number of methodologies for doing it. The way that the military sort of looks at things right now is we take a look at the national security strategy and national defense strategy, those strategic documents, taking a look at principally China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran as our primary state-based threats. And there's also the violent extremist organizations as well. And then, you know, we look at the geography, we evaluate the adversary, you know, sort of what their objectives may be. And even that is complicated because we're seeing increased cooperation between each of those four countries and even the violent extremists as well. So trying to view each one of them on their own terms is an immensely complicated thing. It's also wise to take a look at how technology is changing and sort of what the policy motivations of each of those countries and those violent extremists might be. And based off of that, we can evaluate them based off their most likely and most dangerous courses of action and attempt to resource against those. There's numerous other techniques we use. We'll do war gaming, where we'll have experts play the role of the adversary when you go into combat. And you can do moves and counter moves and just see how that goes. It doesn't determine exactly how a conflict is going to go. It never does, but you can learn a great deal from sort of the dynamic play that goes with it. There's a great deal that happens with area studies and the role of think tanks and informing policy, and just staying abreast of all the changes. And then fundamentally too, war is very unpredictable.
Right.
Combat is very unpredictable. So those who think you can make a straight line projection into the future and how combat is going to be, they're almost certainly going to be wrong.
Yeah.
One of the great, several great leaders have said that America's record of predicting where the next war is going to be is 100% incorrect.
I think that's true.
Yep. And I'll also say, too, that everyone was projecting that when Russia made its reinvasion of Ukraine in 2022, that would be a quick victory on their part. And that has proven to be incorrect as well. That combat is still underway with various peace initiatives going on around it. So it is very complicated to try to forecast these things. And therefore, it sort of enforces a sort of natural conservatism on the part of the military mind in trying to predict these things, because they're almost always are going to be conservative with their estimates because they don't want to lose. And it's their lives that are, for the most part, going to be on the line.
Right. Why has it been so hard for us, Nathaniel, in recent wars to turn victory into the political outcomes we want? Right. So we certainly defeated the Iraqi military, but we had a hard time making Iraq over in the way we wanted it. Right. A similar thing could be said about Afghanistan. And we could go on. You know, our military seems to be successful at winning conflict operations, but then post-conflict operations seem to be very, very difficult for us. Why is that?
I think it has to do with, it sort of goes back to the initial Kennan passage that you read earlier earlier in our talk today, in knowing what your national interest is. Fundamentally, that national interest, that national policy, just by joining combat with the enemy will change, and it becomes a very dynamic thing. And it becomes very complicated. Furthermore, because war is so unpredictable, the war that you enter into is almost never going to be the war that you end because of the changes that undergo with it. So trying to bring it to that type of conclusion is always going to be a chancy business, a complicated one at best. There is an argument to be made that the 2003, we say the 2003 invasion of Iraq, that was its own separate war. That may be true. It may not be true. It might have been a continuation of an air war that we had undergoing with Iraq that was going on prior to that with Operation Northern and Southern Watch, and prior to that to the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was not a single month from February of 1990 through November of 2011, where the United States was not dropping bombs on Iraq. Every single month during that entire time frame, the United States was in a sort of combat. Now, it wasn't a ground combat the entire time, but it was combat. And that should even signify to us how difficult it is to bring a war to a successful conclusion. We tend to look back at the Operation Desert Storm back in 1991 as a successful war termination and a successful war. But I don't think anyone envisioned having to conduct continuous occupation of Iraqi airspace for over a decade following that, and then having to conduct a ground invasion. So this goes back to, again, the passage from Ken, understanding what our national interest is immensely complicated. And doing it in the midst of combat is even harder.
Are there just things that even the best military in the world can't do?
Yes. Yes. Every military is going to have its limits. There is going to be, the greatest generals of all history, almost all of them have had their limits. Napoleon, he had to march back from Russia. And one other thing, too, is hubris almost always sets in. When you are at your most confident, you believe you've completed operations, that is also when, the forces of hubris and the forces of tragedy can enter in very easily, because overconfidence is a thing. It's a very human emotion.
Yes. Yes.
And the enemy, when they're at their weakest, becomes very easy to discount at that point.
Yes.
So there are absolute limits to what the military can do. And that's sort of on the psychological level, but I'll even say this too. Even today, we have limits. We have limitations on our defense industrial base. Mm-hmm. We predicted a war. Many people in the past predicted war would be a very high-tech affair with a great number of precision munitions and long-range sensing and long-range firepower being engaged. But it's still, at the end of the day, many times it's infantrymen with rifles and bayonets conducting war and using things like unguided 155-millimeter artillery rounds, which seem to be in very short supply these days. So even forecasting those types of things is going to be a major challenge.
Yep. Yep. No, it like anything else, the more sophisticated you become, the more the basics matter, right, Nate?
Absolutely.
The basics matter.
It's brilliance in the basics, focus on the fundamentals. That's ultimately what allows small units to succeed. And adaptation and innovation are going to be the types of things that allow us to outcompete against a thinking enemy.
So Zachary, I wanted to turn to you now. I think one of the really positive developments, I think, of the last few years is, even though, as Nate said, we still have a pretty big divide between the civilian life and the military service in our society, certainly at universities like your own, like Yale, ROTC has come back. It had left those campuses during the Vietnam era. It's now back. There seems to be more integration of those choosing military service and those not choosing military service in a university environment. Do you see a positive development there?
I definitely think so. I think at least at places like Yale, it is not only normal, but in some communities, in some groups on campus, the norm to be in ROTC or to consider military service or take it seriously. I think in particular for a lot of young men, but for all sorts of young people, the military offers a kind of sense of purpose that I think is missing for a lot of people. And I think that's something that even those who don't follow that calling have a lot of respect for in my generation.
And so you've experienced this as the ROTC as being an area that draws respect and builds connections on campus.
Certainly. And I think at the very least, they have a large footprint and a large presence, and that most of the students involved are integrated with the rest of campus.
Nate, as a kind of closing question, do you see a positive trend in that we're moving maybe toward, in some ways, some better civil-military relations where environments, particularly some universities that for a while were hostile to military service, are now becoming more open, and maybe I've seen, certainly with military fellows, more openness also to the academic experience when they come back to campus, often as postgraduate fellows. Do you see progress being made in that area?
I do. Yes, absolutely. And I think that there's always going to be problems with it, with civil-military relations, particularly with such a small force and with the military also sort of being more and more a family affair is what it's been in recent decades. Sons and daughters would be serving, and oftentimes from military families, and that sort of continues. So So there is that. But I think at the same time, the more exposure we can get to of civil society, of our institutions, educational institutions, government institutions, even the interagency, the State Department, the intelligence community, you know, the even, you know, things like the tech sector, with, you know, with a variety of new defense industrial startups coming online. All these things are positive developments that I think could lead to potentially greater success for the United States on the military, on the battlefield, and hopefully wiser decisions and solid support from the American people when and if we are having to use force in their name.
Yes, yes. And just to put some numbers on what we've been talking about here, there are approximately 2 million Americans who serve in the military, and that's less than 1%. It's actually closer to half of 1% of the population. So it seems like a lot, but as Nate has said so well, it's actually a very small military, especially in comparison to other smaller societies that have larger militaries. It's an expensive military at $1 trillion in the new budget, but it is small in terms of personnel. I think what's so central to the history of our democracy is just what Nate was talking about, the essential struggle between the military necessities that George Kennan was talking about, defending the national interest, being ready to fight those who would damage our society, to make the world safe for democracy when necessary, but also protecting democratic values and ensuring that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, not a particular ideology or a particular person of any kind. And Nate, I think you embody this in your answers and your discussion today. You embody that commitment to democracy. When you say you serve your country, you're serving our democratic principles. And we're fortunate to have a military filled with people like you. And I hope this discussion has encouraged others to learn more and get more involved either through the military or not, maybe in non-military roles in helping to maintain this important balance between our military and civilian purposes in our society. Nate, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's absolutely my pleasure to join both of you. And I should say is that all the opinions that I'm going to say today are strictly my own and don't represent those of the Department of Defense, the Marine Corps, or any other organization with which I'm associated. Thank you.
I've learned so much from you, Nate, and I look forward to continuing to learn and to continuing to be proud of you serving our country. Zachary, thank you for your thoughtful insights and questions, as always. And thank you most of all to our loyal listeners and loyal subscribers to our Substack for joining us for this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio
and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Scott Holmes.
Stay tuned for a new episode every week.
You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube.
See you next time.